We begin this evening the first of our two sessions devoted to matters of Pesach and the Haggadah. And we'll start with I would call it a Dvar Halacha, as we'll see exactly what that means in this context. The topic that I'd like to address the beginning is the matter of kitnios. So we're all, I think, aware of some of the general aspects of this minhag, but if we see it from its inception and some of its branches, and try and wrap it up if we can. Well, we begin, of course, the most important thing to know about kitnios is that they're not chametz, and the Mishnah states as such. In Maseches Pesachim, in the second perek, the Mishnah enumerates those grains and those items that can become susceptible to chametz. They are the chameshes haminim, no more, no less. Wheat, barley, oats, rye, and spelt. There is actually a minority opinion amongst the Tanoim, we should know, Rabbi Yochanan ben Nuri, who says that rice could also become chametz. The halacha is not like him. And that happens. In fact, the only special mention of rice with regards to Pesach beyond that point is that when the halacha tells us that on the Seder plate there should be shnei tavshilin, two cooked dishes, which for us has become quite specifically the shank bone and the with the zroa and the egg, but in principle any two cooked dishes. And Rav Huna used to have rice as one of his cooked dishes on the Seder plate. It wasn't because he was Fardi, it was because it's the Gemara and kitnius hasn't happened yet. And therefore, in terms of the Gemara, it's very clear that anything outside of the Chameshes Haminim, one doesn't need to avoid or eschew. However, there is an old Ashkenazi minhag. Exactly how old it is, we don't know exactly when it started, and it really, the way that we can date it is basically because one of the Rishonim, the Smak, the Sefer Mitzvahs Katan, one of the great Rishonim, I think it would be in the 1100s, he refers to it as a minhag mikamadoros. This is a minhag that already exists for a number of generations. So all we know is that it preceded the smak by a number of generations, but we don't have a record of exactly when it started. And the question is, what's it all about? Why is it that the minhag in Ashkenaz was to avoid kitnios on Pesach? And there are two, I would say, mainstream answers. There are other additional possibilities, but the two main answers are, number one, the worry that some chametz may actually have gotten into the kitnios. That is to say, it's arovus. These foods tended to be grown or processed near each other. There was the worry that somewhere in the kitnios there was a grain of chametz. As we know, we're very, very particular, much more than any other time of the year, or most other Isurim, really, when it comes to chametz, even a kol shehu, not a speck. And interestingly, I was told by someone who is familiar with the kashrus organization, that kashash actually, in principle, is true even until our time, in the sense that this organization was giving a hefsher to rice, and they found some wheat kernels in the rice. No one meant it badly, but it can happen. And of course, the minhag here is twofold. Number one, to be worried about such a concern. And number two, not to rely on checking. After all, one could almost say, if you're worried that chametz has got mixed in, so check it and see. But really, therefore, the form of the minhag is not to check, as if to say, not to rely on checking, but just to leave the whole thing out. That is the first explanation for this minhag. Chashash tarovus. Perhaps a minute amount of chametz has been mixed into, gotten into, insinuated itself into the kitnios. The second explanation is quite different. Very different, in fact. The second explanation is that It's not so much that chometz will get mixed in with the kidneys, but rather people will confuse kidneys with chometz, as if to say, and we're beginning now, therefore, to almost like define the characteristic of kidneys. They are foods that are either processed in a way that is similar to harvested, that is to say, in a way that's similar to chametz, and that's why you'll have these like small, you know, beans and other grains and such like. Or alternatively, or perhaps additionally, people make the same things out of them as they do out of the chameshes haminim. So rice, for example, is a good example, and so is corn, whereby people will make rice crackers and rice bread, and a lot of the things that you'd make out of chametz, you'd make out of these. And therefore, the worry is, when even if there's no issue that perhaps there's some chametz here, but rather people may see you making these very chametzy type dishes, and they may therefore come to actually do the same with chametz itself. Perhaps you might say, or they might say, that maybe chametz only applies to wheat or only to barley or whatever it may be, because they see these things that are so similar to chametz, and therefore as a safeguard, it's really a gezeira. We see it's a very different type of understanding. It's a gezeira as a protective measure. Anything that you make things out of similar to bread, that's also therefore avoided. So if we could summarize these two explanations for how kidneys comes about. The first explanation is the kidney, that chametz may have gotten mixed in with the kidneys. And the second explanation is that people might get mixed up with the kidneys and it can mistakenly confuse its status with that of chametz. Now, this is an Ashkenazi minhag. We should note also, for the record, that not all Ashkenazi Rishonim, I mean, in its time it was a machlokas, there were certain Ashkenazi Rishonim, venerable Rishonim, who did not avoid kidneys. However, the overwhelming preponderance was, yes, to avoid kidneys, that's number one. It's an Ashkenazi minhag. The Beis Yosef has a wonderful summation of the minhag of kidneys. He records those Rishonim and says, no one's really particular about this, except for Ashkenazim. So that's an interesting feeling. But interestingly, it was a Sephardi godel who actually provided what seems to be basis for the minhag of kidneys from the Gemara. No, it was one of the Sephardi gedolim. That is the Pri Chadash. The Pri Chadash, Rabbi Chizkiah de Silva, one of the early commentaries on the Shulchan Aruch, and Pri Chadash says, if you look in the Gemara in Pesachim, you'll see something very interesting. And that is that Rava was particular. In Pesachim Daf Mem Amud Beis, Rava was particular in his house that they should not make any cooked dish out of lentil flour. And he explained why. He said there are Amei Haaretz, there are people who are unlearned, unlettered, and if they see us making these dishes out of lentil flour, they won't know to distinguish between that and actual chametz flour, which, when you think about it, is kidneys. It's literally the explanation which is later given for kidneys. The point of the minhag is we're extrapolating. If there's Amei Haaretz in Rava's house, then they're probably everywhere. And they are. And therefore it becomes a widespread minhag. My father, Zatzal, always used to quote or unquote the pasuk in Koheles, Dor holeich, v'dor ba, v'am ha'aretz le'olam amedes. There'll always be Amei Haaretz. So that's very interesting because it literally draws a straight line from the minhag of kidneys back to the Gemara. So says the Pri Chadash. By the time we get to the early Acharonim, it is an absolute widespread Ashkenazi minhag. We should note, however, again for the record, that there is one or two of the Acharonim who famously were opposed in their time to the minhag of kidneys for reasons which Baruch Hashem are not applicable anymore. But to put ourselves back in that time, Rabbi Yaakov Emden quotes his father, the Chacham Tzvi, Rabbi Tzvi Ashkenazi, who says that he would like to discontinue the minhag of kidneys. And the reason why, I mean, is he adverse to chumras on Pesach? Not at all. But says Rabbi Yaakov Emden, it could lead to actually a kula, it could lead to a leniency with regards to chametz. How so? How does avoiding kidneys lead to a leniency, perhaps, with regards to chametz? He says very simply, Because in their times, or as he's writing, how many foods do they have? How many types of materials do they have, or ingredients from which they could make food? They've got your flour and water, and then you've got your chitneya surrounded. And therefore, if in the interest of avoiding chametz, says Rabbi Yaakov Emden, you veto all these other foods, essentially you are causing people to increase the workload in terms of what are they left with? Basically flour and water. But flour and water are the only things that actually really can become chametz. And by making them make more and more matzah because there isn't really anything else they could do, there's more room for mishap and to have actual chametz. That was the very interesting point raised by Rabbi Yaakov Emden. Again, it clearly was not successful. And moreover, Baruch Hashem, I mean, to look back at a time where people, if they kept kidneys, they didn't have what to eat. Nowadays, they have kosher Pesach, everything. If you didn't tell someone it was Pesach, he might not know and never have touched a drop of chametz or kidneys. And therefore, we have that shefa. So it's a good position to be able to put that objection, Baruch Hashem, into obscurity. Now, a very revealing, I would say, tshuva and source of information with regards to the minhag of kidneys comes from one of the great Ashkenazi Rishonim, the Truma Sedeshin, Rabbi Yisrael Isserlin. And the question that he raises is whether or not it's mutter to use kidneys oil for a lamp, for illumination. After all, back in the day, whatever oil they had, they would use it for lighting. Can you use kidneys oil for lighting? And the Truma Sedeshin says you can. And the backtrack is as follows. As we know, and it's a good review anyway, chametz actually has three separate Torah prohibitions that relate to it. There is the prohibition against eating or drinking chametz. There is the prohibition against deriving benefit from chametz. And there is even a prohibition against owning chametz, bali roi or bali matze. Of those three, as we know, the prohibition against eating chametz is much more severe than the others. The others are, quote-unquote, just lo sa'aseis. They're forbidden from the Torah, but they're the standard prohibition. But as we know, if one eats chametz on Pesach, he's chayav kares, and that's altogether a different order of stringency. And therefore, says the Truma Sedeshin, the Isser of kidneys only applies to the most severe of those three Torah prohibitions. That is to say, the minhag is only not to eat kidneys. But you can get benefit from kidneys. Therefore, in answer to the question, you could use it to light a lamp, which is benefit from kidneys, and you could also own kidneys. Now here, it's very interesting to observe what we could call the difference between halacha and halacha lamaisa. One always needs to keep an eye on what the pure halacha is, but also conditions perhaps may change. And by that I mean, according to the Truma Sedeshin, you can own kidneys on Pesach. That means if you have kidneys products, there's no need to sell them because you can own them. Why sell what you can own? However, halacha lemaisa is not that way. And the reason why is because much of what we call kidneys products, the way food works nowadays, there tends to be everything in everything, which means even things that are formally kidneys only, or predominantly kidneys, can still have chametz in them. Not because of the minhag of kidneys, just because they've got chametz in the product. Perhaps a classic example would be some brands of cornflakes. Cornflakes, as its name suggests, is from corn, and corn is kidneys. But many types of cornflakes are supplemented with malt from wheat, which is basically chametz. And therefore, a person can have what, by its title, is kidneys, but actually contains chametz, and therefore, strictly speaking, the only kidneys that you wouldn't sell is kidneys that actually is kosher for Pesach. That is to say, it's kosher for those that don't have the minhag of kidneys, Sfardim, etc. So that's an interesting translation, in a sense, or lack of loses in translation from halacha to halacha lemaisa. The Truma Sedeshin also states there that we have to remember, kidneys is not a prohibition. to say this very carefully, it's not a Torah prohibition. It's not even a Durabonon prohibition. In other words, it's not Osir Midrabonon. Chazal never asked it. It's a minag, which is one notch lower than an Isur Drabonon. Important to remember. I always tell the Talmidim, you never say something like it's only a minag. That's not a correct way to refer to it, because that's perhaps have a flippant connotation. It's only a minag. That's like saying, you know, it's only a car or such like. But to say it's a minhag only, that's correct, because it's a minhag and not an isser or either Doraisa or Drabonim. And therefore, says the Truma Sedeshin, because it is a minhag only, if kidneys should get mixed in with other kosher Pesach food, it's mutter to eat. Now, to understand how to handle that information practically, because as true as it is, nonetheless, that's only if it happened, if some kidneys fell into kosher Pesach food. But you couldn't put it there in the outset. And that becomes an interesting question. Well, what if someone else put it there and it's done by the time you come into contact with it? Is that okay? Really, the question is, products which have some kidneys element in it. It's a minority and it's done already. However, the minhag is that as surely as you wouldn't do it yourself at the outset, you don't purchase such a product, which of course relates to many products that have kidneys ingredients, but they themselves are not full kidneys. They're also avoided as part of the minhag. However, it does find expression with regards to the question of kalim, as if to say, if a Sephardi will be hosting an Ashkenazi family, let's say, so he's not going to feed them kidneys, otherwise that may be the end of the relationship. He's not going to feed them kidneys, but he will be cooking and serving with utensils that he has used for kidneys. Is that a problem? Do they need to bring their own plates? So the halacha is they don't, or more correctly, the minhag is they don't, and the reason why is because when it comes to tam of kidneys, because it's a minhag, therefore it's mutter. Some require or advise that whatever kalim is used for hot food should not have been used in the last 24 hours, which isn't really difficult to do, and others don't even require that. Even what's called ben yomo, within 24 hours, it's mutter to have non-kidneous food, or even using kidneous kalim and cooked in kidneous kalim, because of its minhag status, not iser status. What we do see is, from the Truma Sedeshin seemingly quite clearly, is that when we say that kidneys are to be avoided, also kidneys products, that is to say kidneys derivatives, are avoided. Because if we remind ourselves, the question was about oil from kidneys, not about the kidneys itself. Oil from kidneys. And the Truma Sedeshin says, it's okay to use it, because you can use kidneys, but you couldn't consume it. And that tshuva seems to indicate quite clearly that the minhag of kidneys is also about kidneys products and derivatives. There are people who are makil, but they would need to, and there may be complicated reasons why, they would need to reckon with this very seemingly very clear message from the Truma Sedeshin, that kidneys applies to kidneys derivatives as well. But as we come then to consider perhaps other foods that are not on the classic list of kidneys, and over the ages some foods were proposed and taken on, and the question is how to relate to that. And from what I've been able to fathom, there are really two responses to that. The first response might be to ask, how many characteristics do they have in common with kidneys? And an example of that would be a famous suggestion or move of the Chai Odom, Rabbi Avraham Danzig, one of the classic poskim, the Chai Odom, and he, this will sound shocking to us, but he maintained that in the interest of avoiding kidneys, one should also not use potatoes on Pesach. Now for us, Pesach without potatoes, that sounds practically like Pesach without, the Haggadah and matzahs. In fact, some pointed out that had the Chai Odom succeeded in getting potatoes put on the list, that may well have been the end of Chaye Adam. However, it was not taken on, and Shlomo Zalman Auerbach explains, because the move to add it to the list is that it is true that you do actually make from potatoes things quite similar to that which you'd use from grain. You can make starch and flour, etc. and so forth, as we know from Pesach things, from Pesach foods. However, says the Reb Shlomo Zalman, it wasn't similar enough, because all the other things, they're small things, the grains, they have that grain-like quality also, or beans, or in that way. As opposed to potato, when you can't look at a, you see a potato, you can't mistake it for a grain of wheat. And therefore, because it wasn't similar enough, even in that respect, it was not added to the list. A converse, or perhaps actually rather similar, would be the question of peanuts, which was discussed by Ritzi Pesach Frank in the Mikroi Kodesh, and he raises an argument that it shouldn't be on the list of kidneys. And the argument is that as much as on the one hand peanuts are much more similar in terms of their form, shall we say, to the grains, much more than a potato, but something else is lacking, because it's not true that you use peanuts for this to make the same products for which you would use grains. In other words, you don't make flour out of them, etc. and so forth. It's not as widespread. Well, to pardon the expression, but that's basically all that you do use it for. And therefore, we see once again certain characteristics, yes, in common, but not enough. Although with peanuts, there does seem to be a minag to be machmir. But these approaches, what they have in common is that we really do, we're open to the idea that can be new foods. They just need to check out, shall we say, on every level, in every aspect of equation, similar in form, similar in product, similar in harvesting, etc. and so forth. But a very different approach to the question of new foods is found in the Igros Moshe of Moshe Feinstein, and he was also asked about peanuts. And his approach is very different. He says that there's actually a categorical reason to say that no new food should be added. And the reason why, says Rav Moshe, let us remember, kidneys is not an isser. And when we say it's not an isser, that's not only addressing the severity of the issue, but also how did it come about? It's not an isser in the sense that no one formally said, no group of Rishonim or maybe even earlier got together and formally made a takana which says any food that has the following characteristics should be avoided on Pesach because it's too similar to chametz, or for whatever the reason is. There was no such proclamation, there was no such formulation. Rather, what happened was there was a minag, and clearly the minag was encouraged by these Rishonim, but it related to certain foods, and we can surmise the reasons behind those foods. But because it has the form of minag, one fulfills the minag by avoiding those foods. One doesn't need to add foods to that, because that's not what the minag is. And therefore, Reb Moshe really seems to be to understand that kidneys, in principle, is list specific. Whatever's on the original list, the minag is to avoid those foods for good reason. And again, we discussed the reasons, but it doesn't require that if should any other type of food somehow qualify later on, it doesn't matter. That's not the minag. An interesting, perhaps more modern application would be that I think the new grain in the neighborhood for us, which is quinoa, which has become quite popular, even not on Pesach. In fact, as far as I know, in Peru it is the main grain. That's what they make their bread from, and that's the staple for them. And the discussion seemingly would be similar, in the sense that it seems to answer to the characteristics, and actually it would seem to answer to more of the characteristics than any of the other foods, because it, in every respect, it seems to resemble those grains, and it's harvested the same way, used in the same way, and therefore in terms of characteristics, there would be room to be machmir. It really does seem to share them. But in terms of what Reb Moshe says, that if it's list specific, and quinoa is not on the list, so it's not on the list. I could have brought some, but it's hard to describe it. Ask for it, and whatever they show you, that's what it is. Okay. So, just a final in terms of famous case foods that were discussed, another one of them was actually cottonseed oil. And what's interesting about cottonseed oil is that on the one hand, it will produce a product that's it's harvested again similar to the other foods. The only glaring difference is the cottonseed itself is inedible. So here we have a situation where it's actually, until now we've been discussing, is it only the foods or also the derivatives? Here you only have the derivative. There is no food. If you eat cottonseed, you're potter from everything, really. Maybe even from other mitzvahs. It's not a food. And this became a machlokas. Originally it was a famous machlokas because Rav Kook was Makel, and other contemporaries of his were Machmin. It's something that continues, and many of these things become now subject to local minhagim. Even Rav Moshe, back to the question of peanuts, Rav Moshe says he personally does not see that it's part of the list or part of the minhag of kidneys. However, he says to whoever asked him the shaila, he says, if you have a particular minhag to avoid peanuts as well, I'm not telling you that to discontinue that minhag. So they become local minhagim in some respects. Sometimes in Chutz La'aretz they're different minhagim than Eretz Yisrael. With regard to certain things, cottonseed oil is one of those things. So a final point in terms of the scope, shall we say, of the minhag of kidneys, and again bearing in mind that it is a minhag only, there is leeway with kidneys that you don't find with isurim proper, and that is if someone has dietary needs, for example, significant, someone who is unwell, even if he's not very unwell, and also for young children, right, if they need their cereal or whatever it would be, it may be, and it's they have brand loyalty, these young kids, babies, certainly, and the formula requires a kidneys. So again, if it's got to be kosher Pesach, you don't want in the name of kidneys for them to be eating actual chametz as well, but if it's kosher Pesach, so then obviously a rav is consulted, but the principle is that it's mutter. And a famous case actually that related to leniency with regards to the minhag of kidneys was a year of famine, which took place in the city of Brisk. And this is in the days of early Acharonim, the Maharam Mibrisk. He, for that year, suspended kidneys. And the reason why is because people very simply didn't have what to eat. I mean, it wasn't enough. There wasn't enough matzah to go around. And he claimed that for such a situation, the minhag of kidneys was never taken on. I mean, the kidneys, to avoid those foods and enjoy your matzah. If you don't have any matzah, because there's just no food anywhere, so then he was lenient there. And interestingly, in what became a point of discussion, he was lenient for the entire town, meaning even people that had enough food, not only those that didn't. And that was very interesting. And in fact, there are two versions as to why he did that. After all, the people who were rich, they don't need. So why are you telling them that the kidneys is mutter for them? So the official reason, which actually appears in the tshuva, there in the tshuva of Maharam Mibrisk, is that if the rich people, those that have, if they don't eat kidneys, then the poor people, they'll feel they're doing something wrong by eating kidneys, because they look at their rich neighbor and avoiding everything that they're eating, and they'll feel they're doing Yisurim, and therefore, in order that shouldn't happen, he said everyone can eat kidneys, which is a very interesting thing to say. But a later Shela Sechuvus, the Divrei Malkiel, actually states that he heard a tradition that there was something else behind the Maharam of Brisk saying that everyone can eat kidneys, and that is there were certain people in Brisk at that time, and this can happen sometimes, who they formally or officially belonged to the Ashirim, but they didn't really have, in other words, they presented themselves as part of the upper class, but really they didn't have anything, and therefore they were basically Aniyim, masquerading as Ashirim, or for social purposes, and therefore if it was also for Ashirim, you'd actually have Aniyim. Who didn't have anything to eat, and therefore that's why, in order to protect those Aniyim who presented themselves as Ashirim, he said everyone can eat. So this, I must say, in a nutshell, is the minhag of kidneys, and Baruch Hashem, we're so far removed from any reason for heterim, and of all the minhagim of Pesach, kidneys is certainly one of the most antiquated, most venerated for people of Ashkenaz. And what's important on the one hand is not to make more of it than it is. We see that it's less stringent than an actual iser on the one hand, but on the other hand, to be flippant about it is terrible, for no reason, just because it's there almost. And the Aruch HaShulchan, in his concluding comments with regards to the minhag of kitnius, he says it's a well-established Ashkenazi minhag. The hamapakbikim umekilim, people who are just for no reason, just capriciously lenient with regards to kitnias, meidim al atzmam she'ein bohem yiras shamayim v'yiras chet. They are testifying about themselves. They don't have fear of heaven. They're just disposing wantonly with a well-established Ashkenazi minhag, and therefore that also needs to be taken into account, as we know, especially when it comes to Pesach. Just a final point. Minhagim and Pesach have a very special relationship, as Meshech Chochma points out in Parshas Bo, because all we had going for us when we left Mitzrayim were Minhagim. We were saved because of our Minhagim. What did we have? And the only thing that stopped us from absolute assimilation was preserving Jewish customs, because mitzvahs we didn't have, and other mitzvahs we weren't actually so doing so well in. But the famous, we didn't change our names, and we didn't change our language, and we didn't change our... Those are minhagim, and look where they got us. They got us to Geula. So if there's any place that one should celebrate minhagim and appreciate them, certainly Pesach is one of those places. So that's with regards to kidneys. And Baruch Hashem, any supermarket, you just got to note that if it says kosher Pesach, it doesn't say in microscopic print, L'ot le'kitnius bilvad. A few people have had mishaps there, but there's plenty for everyone. And from there, let us open the Haggadah itself. We begin, of course, with Holach Ma'anya. It's at the beginning, can't fail to catch everyone's attention. And the classic question, of course, is what's it doing in Aramaic? Holach Ma'anya, you get three sentences of Aramaic before the rest of the Haggadah is in Hebrew. Well, the classic answer, which I'm sure we're familiar with, is it's in Aramaic because it's very important for everyone to understand the Seder, which it is. There's no question about that. That is halacha lemaisa. There's no mitzvah to read the Haggadah in Hebrew if those present do not speak Hebrew. If they only speak English, then it should be at the very least translated into English. There is no mitzvah to recite the Haggadah. You have to tell the story through the Haggadah. In fact, the Shulchan Aruch in Hilchos Pesach quotes one of the Rishonim of England, Rabbeinu Yehuda of London, and states that in his Seder table he would say the Haggadah in English so that his family, some members of the family did not speak Hebrew, they speak English, he would say the Seder in English. So that's a record in Shulchan Aruch of someone who would say Haggadah in the vernacular. Time was, back when the Mishnah was, that people spoke Aramaic better than they saw something very difficult for us to relate to. If you can understand Aramaic, how can you not understand Hebrew? But they didn't. And that's where the minhag of reading from Unculus at the time of laning existed in the days of the Mishnah. There was a meturgeman. They would read a pasuk from the Torah, and many people wouldn't understand what it was saying, and then they translate it into Aramaic, and then everyone would light up and finally understand. And therefore, since it's important for everyone to understand what's being said, and since time was that people spoke Aramaic, even if they didn't speak Hebrew, that's why this paragraph is in Aramaic. The problems with this explanation, or the points that may be raised regarding this explanation, is number one, if that's true, it's difficult to understand why it would be preserved in that way. Because if it's functional, just that people should understand, and nowadays, if you don't understand Hebrew, kal vachomer, you don't understand Aramaic, so then maybe bring it back into Hebrew, or maybe everyone should say it in their own vernacular, which we don't. We keep it in the Aramaic. So now it seems more remote than ever from people understanding. If they never heard the words kol dich ben yeseh v'yechol, they're not going to get it on Seder night. And moreover, there are many sections of the Haggadah which are much more critical to fulfilling the mitzvah. Rabbi Gamliel's famous three things, Pesach, Matzah, and Maror, Avodah Mayinu, is really the basic, why they should be in Aramaic. I mean, those are the crucial points, and they're not. So it seems to be more maybe a remainder, a remnant of, from the time. But Rashi says something else, which I thought was very, Rashi in this Perush on the Haggadah, very thought-provoking. Rashi directs our attention to the Gemara in Masechta Shabbos and Daf Yud Beis, which tells us that there's something interesting about Aramaic. The Malachim, they don't relate to it. They don't address themselves to it. They don't respond to it, so to speak. It's for that reason that generally one doesn't like to pray in Aramaic, even back in the day, because one wants to use the Malachim as a conduit for the Tefillah. That's what the Gemara says. However, there are certain things that actually we would prefer that the Malachim didn't get involved in, because it may lead to what's called kitruk. It may lead to accusation or indictment. A classic example, just parenthetically, but according to one opinion in Tosfos, that's why Kaddish is in Aramaic. So the Tosfos quote this opinion in Maseches Brachos and Daf Gimel, Kaddish is in Aramaic, because it's such a lofty praise. We don't want the Malachim involved, because if they were, they would be Mekatrek, and what would they say? How can human beings say such an elevated praise? But we want to, but we don't want to have issues. So we choose the language that they don't respond to, and that's how we're able to say Kaddish, to say this praise in Aramaic. Rashi says similarly, very interesting. We begin the Seder, Holach Ma'anya. We start our Seder, we start it in Aramaic. And the reason why, we do not wish to introduce the Seder in Hebrew, because then if the Malachim are involved, they may also be Mekatrik. How could they possibly accuse us? What are we doing? We're fulfilling the Seder. It's a good thing. Says Rashi, we're celebrating Yetzias Mitzrayim. If we're back in Golos, then we have the capacity to get out of the present Golos. But somehow we're not doing it. So it doesn't mean you shouldn't celebrate Pesach. But as soon as you do, we were in Golos, and then we were saved, and if the Malachim latch onto that, so there'll be a Kitruk. And where are you now? Back in Golos? And what are you doing about it? So interestingly, it's a good question. But Rashi's point is, it's a question that we'd rather prefer to ask ourselves. We can answer it perhaps in a way that's a little easier for us. We don't want to have Malachim asking us that question, but it is a good question. And maybe that is really part of Halach Ma'anya. As we say in Aramaic, we should be conscious of the fact that we really are avoiding a rather confrontational question, but we shouldn't avoid the question itself. And that itself is an interesting way to begin the Seder. We're celebrating Golos, leaving Golos, but we're back, and we know that we have the capacity, each one in their own way, and that's a good goal, in a sense, to get out of this one as well, not just the first one. we proceed to say, Kol dichvin yeseh v'yechol, kol ditzrich yeseh v'yivsach, anyone who's hungry, let him come and eat, anyone who's needy, let him come and spend Pesach with us. And that seems to be somewhat repetitive in the sense that it seems to be the same thing. If you're hungry, if you're needy, if there's people who are hungry are needy, and vice versa. But the Abu Dharam, in his Perush to the Haggadah, explains that actually we're addressing two types of needs. It's interesting, you know, when it comes Pesach, people have Pesach needs. But on Pesach, people also have their normal needs. And there's some people that, Pesach aside, I mean, they just don't have food. And therefore we begin, even before we get to Pesach, maybe you don't have your Shmura Matzah, maybe you don't have anything. And therefore, in terms of the much more, the very basic, elemental hachnos asorochim, kol dichvin, if you're hungry, why are you hungry? Not because you don't have enough matzah, you don't have anything. Yeseh v'yechol, come, there's food here, come and join us. And then, kol ditzrich, yeseh v'yivsach, if you have needs, meaning specific Pesach needs, yeseh v'yivsach, we have Pesach things, we've got your matzah, we've got everything that you need. It brings to mind, actually, a famous story that took place with the Beis Halevi. Someone once came and asked the Beis Halevi a shaila. It was a few days before Pesach. His question was, one should have wine for the Arba Kosos. He says, would it be possible to use milk for Arba Kosos? I guess he was a farmer or something. Milk he had access to, but wine he didn't have wine. So interestingly, the Beis Halevi did not respond with a Psak Halacha. He responded by giving this person some money. Which is, sometimes you tell him the Halacha, and sometimes you obviate the question. He took out some money, and he gave it to him as a loan, actually. He knew as a gift the person would refuse, he gave it to him as a loan, which he assumed would not be paid back, but it made it easier to accept. And he sent him on his way, so the person was very appreciative, and he went, and he bought his wine. There's a Beis Halevi's wife, who was witness to this transaction, or she was nearby, she noticed that he gave this man quite a lot more money than you need to buy wine. And how much wine is he going to buy already? 4 cups? And so why'd you give him that amount? So the Beis Halevi says, if someone is asking me if he can have milk for abrikosos, tells me very clearly he doesn't have wine, but he also doesn't have meat. Because otherwise, how could he have milk for his abrikosos? He doesn't have anything. So if I'm really going to help him out, I've got to give him the wherewithal for everything he needs, not just the wine, but the meat as well, without which he wouldn't even countenance having milk for abrikosos. So that's called a full response to the question. That's called dichvin alongside called ditzrich. And then we conclude, it's interesting how the parts of halach ma'anya, they seem to be disjointed one from the other. This is the bread of affliction. Anyone who's hungry. Next year in Jerusalem. Or next year in Ba'arad Yisrael. Next year B'nei Chorin. What's that got to do with us? So the Abu Dharam again says something very wonderful. This is what you say. Imagine someone who has nothing on Pesach. I mean, that's not a good state to be in. So he accepts your invitation. But these, so what are you going to say? Eat up, you're welcome. You say more than that. You say, this is a temporary thing. Next year, Hashata, Hashata, L'shana ba'ara, Yisrael, L'shana ba'b'nei Chorin. Next year, everyone will have everything. Don't worry. You could almost wish him that you won't see him next year. Because next year, you'll be hosting him to his own. Well, actually, as the Bina Le'itim adds, L'shana ba'ara, Yisrael, says the Balabas, which is the most amazing thing you can say to a needy guest. This year is by me. Next year will be by you. L'shana baba ardi yisrael, l'shana b'nei chorin. And then he can eat belev sameach. That's how halach ma'anya goes together. The final sentence of halach ma'anya also seems to be somewhat doubled over. This year here, next year in Eretz Yisrael, this year slaves, next year b'nei chorin. I mean, do the two go together? So the Rashbats, Rabbi Shimon ben Tzemach, one of the late Rishonim, says no, they don't go together necessarily, and they are a progression. And as always, we begin with the lesser request, and then emboldened, we move on to the greater request. The first thing we ask is geographical. This year here in Golus, next year in Eretz Yisrael. However, there's a further request. Because, says the Rashbat, it's possible to have moved from Golas to Eretz Yisrael and still be Avdei, and still be slaves. And therefore, there's a follow-up request, not only in Eretz Yisrael, but also B'nei Chorin. And I think that really resonates, certainly in our times, but Baruch Hashem, one could say, at least on an individual level, there are many people that they are in Eretz Yisrael. So unless you say that it's really a request on behalf of the entire Jewish people, because the entire Jewish people are not yet in Eretz Yisrael. So for those not yet there, which represents a significant portion of the Jewish people as a whole, this year, Jewish people are not all in Eretz Yisrael. Next year, they should all be in Eretz Yisrael. But even for those individuals who are, to be in Eretz Yisrael doesn't automatically mean to be a B'nai Chorin, and it's really, that's a lot of food for thought in terms of what B'nai Chorin means for us as possible, still be answerable to so many people, to still be subjected to so many people, to their opinions, to their purse strings, to their criticisms, and so many other things. And therefore, that's the follow-up request, and indeed one worthy of Seder night. B'nei Chorin, in the full sense of the word, free of people that would have us do things that are not correct, and free to do that which is absolutely, yes, correct. From there, we move on to the Manishtana. And Manishtana is followed by Avodamayinu. The child asks the questions, and then we answer Avodamayinu. And it's very interesting to consider, to ask the question, how many of the questions of Manishtana are actually answered with a paragraph of Avodamayinu. Sometimes we may forget, because especially if it's a young child who's asking Manishtana, we're so delighted that he said Manishtana, no one is keeping track of whether any of his questions are answered, and certainly, if so, how many of them. But we should. And that is the question. How much of Manishtana is actually addressed with Avodamayinu? And interestingly, that actually would be based on a prior question, an interesting Shaila. And that is, how many questions is the child, or whoever says Manishtana, how many questions is he asking? Now, we may say the answer is very simple. He's asking four questions. In fact, Manishtana is called the four questions, but that's not honest, because who called them the four questions? And we're not beholden to whoever called them the four questions. We have to start before that point. Are there really four questions? Well, maybe. He certainly mentioned, but are they all, you know, each one separate questions for which he demands a response? And here we have a machlokas between two of the later Rishonim. The Abarbanel, in his monumental Peirush Zevach Pesach, on Haggadah Shel Pesach, he explains, maintains, that actually there is only one question in Manishtana. It has four parts to it. I mean, it has four pieces, but they're all heading towards what's essentially one question. And Manishtana, Laila Zeh, is basically an expression of like what a strange night it is. But what is strange about it? Now, you may say, well, that's strange and that's strange, but really, says Abarbanel, there's an overarching question, or more correctly, an underlying question here. And that is, what's strange about the evening is that it seems to be heading in two conflicting directions. That is to say, it seems to be commemorating two very different themes. And he proceeds to elaborate, says the child. I'll tell you what I mean. On all other nights, we have chametz and matzah. Tonight, only matzah. The child looks at the matzah, he sees lechem only. It was seemingly we're commemorating poverty of some sort. Certainly the second question. All other nights, you can eat any other vegetable. Tonight, bitter vegetables. We seem to be commemorating something bitter. Is that it? But then contrast that with the other things that he sees. Piochol HaLeilos, we never dip, which is a very, you know, regal thing to do. Halayla Zeshtei Pa'amim, we're dining like kings. No other night, but Yoshme Mesubim, tonight everyone's Mesubim. So we're celebrating. And that is the question of the child. I mean, which direction? He's confused. Manishtana, what a strange evening. Manishtana, is it commemorating bad times or good times? That is the one question of Manishtana, with its four parts to construct it. And because that's the question, says Abarbanel, the answer to that question is in Avodamayinu. Because Avodamayinu, if the question is, are we commemorating bitter times or good times? The answer is yes. Both. Because Avodamayinu, we went through bitter times, Ayotzeinu, and Hashem took us out, and it's important to commemorate both of them. As we know, Maschilim Bignus, we begin by remembering the bitter times, Mesayim Bashevach, we end up with the better times, and you've got to commemorate the bitter times, because otherwise you don't appreciate the better times. You just imagine that they're all coming to you, and it was always like that. That, therefore, is the answer to the question of Manishtana, says Abarbanel. However, the Shibboleth HaLeket, again, many, many Rishonim who have their comments and their commentaries on the Haggadah, Shibboleth HaLeket actually understands that there are four questions. In other words, the questioner is interested in an itemized response to each of his questions. Why do we have only matzah tonight? Why do we have only mara? Why are we dipping twice, and why are we mesubim? Well, if there's actually four questions, then, so now, we need to track, well, how many have we answered with Avodamayinu? It's good to know Avodamayinu, but how much does that explain? Says the Shibboleth HaLeket, actually, of those four questions, only one of them is answered with Avodah Mayinu. And that's the final question. The final question is, how come we're all Mesubin? Why are we all celebrating? The answer is we're celebrating because Avodah Mayinu, Vayotzieinu, and Hashem took us out, and therefore we're reclining. It's a celebratory meal. And that's the only question that is addressed with Avodah Mayinu. What about the other questions? Are we going to leave them? Says the Shibboleth Leket. No one's leaving them, but the time isn't right for them yet. In the course of Magid, they will get their full teshit. Matzah's going to get a whole paragraph from a Rabban Gamliel. So is Maror. Matzah Zoshanu Ochlin. Maror Zoshanu Ochlin. We hope the child is still there, because he's got to stick around for the answers to his questions. But they will come, each one in its place. The only question, says the Shibboleth Leket, which is not formally answered, is the Matbilin Shnei Pa'amim. Parenthetically, with the Abarbanel, we could answer that's also part of celebrating Avodah Mayinu. But Shibboleth Leket understands that the dipping twice is unusual for unusual sake. It is entirely in order to arouse the curiosity of the child, which means of the four questions, if he asked that one, we're just happy that he asked. But no one will ever answer that question of Matbilin Shnei Pa'amim. That's how the Shibboleth Leket understands. Brings to mind, was told to me by someone who heard this from Rav Shlomo Zalman Orbach himself, that when he was a young child, and he asked the Manishtana, it's going back a while, he asked the Manishtana. And then the next morning, so after Yom Tov, so this was the early 1900s, they were davening in shul in the morning, and they went to say good Yom Tov to the Rav. Who's the Rav of the shul? Rav Yosef Chaim Sonnenfeld. So Shlomo Zalman's father takes him to the Rav, say good Yom Tov. So Rav Sonnenfeld says, who asked the Manishtana? So the young Shlomo Zalman Orbach said, I did. And so Rav Sonnenfeld says, okay, well, so why do we dip twice? Did you ask why we dip twice? He said, yeah. He said, well, why do we dip twice? And Shlomo Zalman said 70 years later, he still remembered how his cheeks burned from at that moment. He didn't occur to him that no one had actually told him why we did twice, which is the answer to his question. I think he was vigilant from that point on. But that's really the Shibboleth Leket. It's a question which isn't answered. If you're asking, that's good enough, and then we'll get to talk about what we need to talk about. We conclude Avodah Mayinu by saying that Afilu kulanu chachamim, kulanu nevonim, kulanu yedim esaterah, even if we know the whole story, it's still a mitzvah to tell it. And the question is, why would we think that if we're wise, we wouldn't need to tell it? Well, the answer might seem self-evident. In other words, we would think that if we're wise and we know the story, so why do you have to tell the story if you know it already? And the answer, of course, is because telling the story is more than knowing it. It's about experiencing it. Even if you know it, you've got to experience it. When the Jewish people left Mitzrayim, no one stayed behind just because they said, oh, I know what's going to happen now. You've got to leave. And you've got to leave every year through telling the story. But there is another very interesting answer to this question. Why would we think that if we're chachamim, then we shouldn't need to tell the story? As we know, Yetzias Mitzrayim, Avodah Mayinu, we were slaves, Vayotzieinu. Jewish people were slaves. But one segment of the Jewish people were not slaves, and that's Shevet Levi. And why were they not slaves? They never got involved in the work in the first place. They never got roped into it, because they were involved in Torah. And therefore, says the Chidah, a person who's a Chacham might think, you know, maybe I don't need to tell the story like everyone else, because if I was there, I wouldn't have got involved in the first place, people like me. I would be a Shevet Levi type person. So the answer is everyone's got to tell the story. Because even if you're Shevet Levi, if you're part of the Jewish people, and this is still your story, it's the story of your people, and even if you weren't involved in the work, but so much other things happened, but that's where it comes from. And interestingly, says the Chidah, that is why we follow up with the famous Maisa, Rabbi Yeshua, Rabbi Tarfon, Rabbi Kiva, Elazar ben Azariah, They were all telling the story. Why are we bringing the story? So it's in order to illustrate this idea that even if we're kulanu chachamim, they were also chachamim, maybe even more than us. And they still told the story, and that illustrates that point. But the Chida says it's more than that. Of those five chachamim in that story, none of them were descended from people who were actually enlisted in the service of Paro. Because three of them were Kohanim. That's Rabbi Eliezer, Rabbi Tarfon, and Rabbi Elazar ben Azariah, were all Kohanim. Rabbi Yeshua is a Levi, which leaves Rabbi Akiva, who was descended from Gerim. So actually none of them had ancestors directly who were involved in the work. But they told the story anyway, because they're part of the Jewish people. And that's what illustrates. Don't think that you could be sectarian in that way and say, oh, I would have been okay, which means it's not so much my story. It's everyone's story if you're part of the Jewish people. So says the Chida. And this brings us as the final segment for this evening to the four sons. And if we take a look at the Ben Rasha, as we know, the Rasha tends to get a lot of attention anyway, so he asks his famous Mahavodazos Lachem, what's this for you? And he means, because he's also a bit of a Chacham, this Rasha. If he wasn't a Chacham, he wouldn't be such a Rasha. So he knows how to make an inference. Lachem, meaning Lachem below low, for you and not for him. And we answer really in kind. Because we say, Ba'avorzeh osa Hashemni, betzeisi mi Mitzrayim. This is what Hashem did for me, leave alo lo. In other words, we kind of answer him a little bit in his language. What's interesting is, and Rishonim already point out, this question features in the Torah. And the answer that we give is not the answer that the Torah gives. And the Torah in Parshas Bo says, when the question comes, Ma avodazos lachem, the answer is, Vamartem zevach pesach ulashem. You tell them the whole story. What we will say in Rabbi Gamliel's paragraph on Korban Pesach, zevach pesach ulashem. What are we doing? It's Korban Pesach. It's a zecher for Makas Bechoros. Right? We kind of answer him much more nicely. And that's what the Torah says. So then the question is, why do we on Seder night, or why does the Haggadah not provide the answer that the Torah provided for this son? That's the question. It's true for the Chacham also, but we'll have to deal with that at a different time. The answer we give is not the answer the Torah gives to his question in Parshas Vayeschana. But back to the Ben Rasha. The Ritva, Rabbi Yom Tov Alashbili, again one of the Rishonim, has a wonderful Perush. What's interesting about this question is that in distinction or contrast with other questions where it says Kish Alcha Bincha, which is true of the Tam and the Chacham, the Ein Yodei L'Shaal doesn't ask, but the Tam and the Chacham, Kish Alcha Bincha, in the singular. But when it comes to the Rasha, it says Ki Yomur Aleichem Bineichem, in the plural. So the Ritva says, why is this question in the plural? Because the question Ma HaAvodah HaZos Lachem can be asked in more than one way. Different people ask it in different ways. Some people may ask it in a very innocent way. It's just, you know, what is this avoda for you? What are you doing? And if it's asked in a positive way, you should get a positive response. He doesn't know. So tell him. And that's what the Torah does. Oh, you didn't know. It's Devar Pesach, Hashem Pesach, etc. But there's another way to ask the question, and that's the... And by the way, the Rashi famously tells us that after Moshe gives the formula, they say Ma'avo Dozos Lachem, Va'amartem Zevach Pesach, it says Va'yikot Ha'am Va'yishtachavu. We quote, why Va'yishtachavu? They bow down because of Al Besoros Habonim, because they're told about their children, except they're told their children be Rishayim. What exactly are they being so thankful for? Within context, it's an innocent question. It's a positive way, and therefore they give thanks for Besoros Habonim. However, the Haggadah is addressing the one who has more sinister agenda as he asks the question, and to him the answer is, if he's not asking it in a nice way and a nice answer, that's not really what he's after. He needs a little bit more. He needs to understand that his words have consequences, and therefore he says, "Ma'avod Hashem Lachem, you're not interested." So we say to him, "You should know. No one's forcing you to do anything. But Ilu Hayasham, Lo Hayanigal, if you would have been there, you wouldn't have been redeemed. No one forced you, but just be aware. Because very often, a lot of these questions are asked, assuming that the questioner will still have all the benefits of abdicating and the luxury yet of asking all of these questions. That much he needs to be told. The two go together. And as we've mentioned in the past from Rabbi Yaakov of Lissa, the Maaseh Nissim, we say, Bavor zeh asah Hashem li betzeisi mimitzrayim. Ilu hayasham lo hayanigal. The verb is shifted. If it's a direct inference, we should say, Ilu hayasham lo hayayotzei, if it's about betzeisi mimitzrayim. But the point is, we don't tell the child he wouldn't have come out. Maybe he would come out. If he wants to come out, he can come out. But if he wouldn't have been part of the geula. And that's a sad situation to be in, to be part of the people that leave, but not really part of what they're doing, part of the actual redemption and the destiny of the Jewish people. And that at the very least is food for thought. But at the end of the day, it's meant not to antagonize, but just to alert, just to goad him to think a little bit. For we say, V'igadata levincha bayomahu lemor. That's the pasuk of Seder night. Haggadah, as we know, represents things that are harsh. Koshim kegidim. Amira is amira raka. Sometimes you have to say something harsh, but the goal should always be at the end of the day, lemor, to bring about a positive response. And that's the ray of hope there with the Pin Russia. We'll leave our discussions over here for this evening and carry on next week.